for having me. I'm looking forward to talking to all the interesting people here. So, all right, this title is kind of vague, and I'll explain more concretely what I'm going to be talking about. But this is based mostly on some work with Steve Schenker and with Gary Borowitz. Okay, so I'm going to have a little introduction here, and then we'll get to the concrete problem that I'm going to solve. So string theory, as we understand it right now, has lots of vacua. All right, and I'm going to be kind of brief in this introduction, so please stop me if you want me to expand on something here. All right, and it also has a mechanism for producing large space-time regions in each one of these vacua. For producing things like what we observe. And that mechanism is eternal inflation. Okay, so great. So this is a concrete realization of the anthropic solution to the cosmological constant problem, among other things. We have all these vacua. We have a mechanism for producing them. So all we have to do. So there are some details that remain to be worked out before this is fully concrete. But eternal inflation, what I have in mind here is false vacuum eternal inflation. So I'll go into this in more detail in a moment. All right, so there are a lot of details that are not worked out here. But roughly, this is our understanding. We have this. We have plenty of eternally inflating vacua around. We have lots of vacua. So all we have to do is count. Just count, you know, how many observers out there are observing this lambda versus that lambda. Okay? So, seems like no problem. The problem is that eternal inflation is too good at what it does. It produces infinities. It produces infinite numbers of each type of bubble. So I'm imagining some kind of false vacuum eternal inflation at the moment, and I'll be more specific. So as a simple model, you could have something like this, some other vacuum over here. And if the decay time here is long compared to the Hubble time, then if the universe starts out with at least a Hubble volume in this state, then it will never entirely decay. It will shed all, it will produce a lot of bubbles of different vacua. But the amount of volume still sitting in the false vacuum will increase with time. Okay, so decay happens by bubble nucleation. Each bubble becomes an infinite open FRW universe. So there's actually two different infinities. There's an infinite number of bubbles of each type. And there's also an infinite volume inside each bubble. Okay, and if this is not such a familiar concept, I will go into more detail. So we have some infinities here. Now, shouldn't string theory or some consistent theory of quantum gravity, shouldn't that tell us how to regulate these infinities? Okay. The problem is our understanding of this whole picture is purely at the semi-classical level. So we don't know how to ask string theory to regulate these infinities. Okay. So once you start worrying about these infinities, you realize, okay, this is a pretty convincing semi-classical story. There's no reason to think that it's not self-consistent. But it would be nice to have a better understanding that would go beyond the semi-classical understanding. Okay. So what I want to do then is I want to step back and just ask the simplest question, which is, about eternal inflation and try to understand this in a slightly more rigorous way, which is, what do the asymptotics look like inside the true vacuum bubbles? All right, this is one of the easiest questions you could ask. We don't have to worry about any more exponential inflation and so on. All right, so I want to start with the simplest question as a way of understanding, as a way of beginning to understand eternal inflation more concretely. Okay? Right, so there's two types of true vacuum bubbles. There's lambda equals zero, and there's negative lambda. Okay, our understanding is that the sitter space can never be completely stable. And in a conformal diagram, what these two types of bubbles look like is this. We have some de Sitter space outside here. And so here's a bubble of negative lambda. Okay, we have de Sitter space outside. And what we produce inside here is an infinite open FRW universe, okay, along some slices like this. Doesn't look very infinite in the conformal diagram. And since this has negative cosmological constant, there's going to be a crunch. So, okay, this doesn't seem like the easiest thing to start to understand more rigorously. Space-like singularities, in particular big crunches, are not the thing we understand the best. But there's another type of true vacuum region, which has zero cosmological constant. Okay, so I'm imagining some large surface that's been produced by eternal inflation here. There's another type of true vacuum region which has zero cosmological constant, which has nice asymptotics. This is just, it is, again, an infinite open FRW universe, but asymptotically it empties out. Things look locally like Minkowski space. And so you might be able to define something like an S matrix element. Up here, you have asymptotically non-interacting particles. Okay, and this is an idea that's been pursued with Lenny and also with some other collaborators at Stanford. The idea that the thing which might be well-defined in string theory is some sort of S matrix or some kind of asymptotic state, or perhaps a dual conformal field theory, which in some sense lives in these lambda equals zero regions. Yeah. Right. Well, they're not, I wouldn't say they're measure zero. I mean, as far as we understand, there's a finite number of vacua. And we have a mechanism for making lambda equals zero, which is supersymmetry. So if you wouldn't have something like supersymmetry, I would say there's probably no lambda equals zero vacua. But we do have them. So in particular, you know, take type 2B string theory and compactify on some Calabi-Yau. You have enough supersymmetry left that there's guaranteed to be zero cosmological constant. You're going to have, it's not going to be particularly four-dimensional. You're going to have a whole moduli space. But that's fine for my purposes. Okay, and the question of whether you have stabilized four-dimensional lambda equals zero, I think, is not really known. Okay, but that's not going to be important here, because I'm not trying to live inside this lambda equals zero. I'm just trying to understand the asymptotics here. So I would say these things definitely exist, because of these supersymmetric compactifications are one thing we actually understand pretty well. Okay, so. All right, so this is an interesting question, trying to define some string theory quantities in here. But I'm gonna focus on a different question here, which is whether these lambda equals zero regions really have such nice asymptotics as I've drawn here. Okay, so the danger to these nice asymptotics is we know from Guth and Weinberg that any true vacuum bubble will collide with an infinite number of other bubbles. I mean, you know, these bubble nucleation processes are rare, but on the other hand, this thing grows to be infinite size, and asymptotically, the amount of pore volume here, I know it doesn't look huge, but the amount of pore volume here in the backward light cone is infinite, so you're guaranteed to nucleate other true vacuum bubbles in there, and those are guaranteed to collide. Some of those will collide with this bubble. Okay, so and in particular, there's nothing to prevent, generically, these ADS bubbles from colliding with the lambda equals zero bubbles. You might imagine some weird potential where it can't happen, but in general, it can happen. So just as a cartoon, we could imagine a potential like this. We have some nice lambda equals zero over here. All right. So we have this ADS vacuum. All right. So we can make both of these types of bubbles, and they can collide with each other. Okay. So the question then that I want to ask is, we have this nice lambda equals zero bubble that we've been focusing on here. All right, but this is going to collide. So here's the sitter space outside here again. This is going to collide with some ADS bubble. We know that over here there's going to be a big crunch. We know that over here we're going to have these nice asymptotics. And the question is, what happens in between? Is there a sense in which the big crunch eats up the entire space-time? In particular, the question I want to focus on is time-like infinity of lambda equals zero destroyed by this collision? In other words, do all time-like geodesics end in the crunch? Or are there time-like geodesics which can have infinite length and be non-singular? Okay, so this is the question that I want to ask here. What is the future evolution inside here? And so let me just clarify two things. One is that whatever you think of all these motivations, this turns out to be a very nice GR problem with a rich set of solutions. Okay, so it's interesting already at that level. And the other thing I want to clarify is that my motivation here was to understand eternal inflation somewhat beyond the semi-classical approximation. What I'm going to do here is just a semi-classical calculation. It's really a classical calculation, because the only thing that uses quantum mechanics is these bubble nucleations here. The question is just the classical evolution after this collision. Okay, and my thinking here is that, okay, if we understand at the classical level that we should have these nice asymptotics, then we should be able to put this on some more rigorous footing later. But it's already interesting just to understand at the semi-classical level what you expect asymptotically. Okay, and then if you expect something nice, then we can try to make that more rigorous in the future. Okay, so this is just going to be a classical calculation. And even though there's an infinite number of bubble collisions, I'm just going to focus on one. Okay, so it's just a collision between lambda equals zero and negative lambda. So that's the actual problem that I'm actually going to solve here. So are there any questions about the setup or the motivation before we go into actually writing equations?
If you're going to use semi-classical reasoning to analyze, say, a potential like the one you wrote down there, where you've got ds, then lambda equals zero, then less than zero, do you actually have like an action principle that admit all three of those extrema as kind of genuine stationary points of your action?
I'm not sure at what level you're asking the question. I mean, I think that gravity coupled to the scalar field with this potential is a consistent theory that I can write down. If you're going to ask me about some kind of quantum gravity corrections, then I'll admit that, no, I don't know what I'm doing. Right. Right.
No one's ever done it for a potential with extrema with different space-time asymptotics.
Well, really all I'm going to do here is Cauchy evolution. I'm going to start with some slice here. I mean, I'm not going to really do it that way, but I'm going to start with some slice here where these bubbles already all exist. They've gotten big and classical. And then I'm going to evolve. And I'm not going to care what's out here. So in some sense, I don't even have spatial asymptotics, or those are not even relevant to me.
Okay, I'll
hold
on to my question.
In that sense,
when you say semi-classical, I assume things like Coleman Deluccia and stuff like that.
Well,
if that's not what you're going to worry about, then I'll...
Coleman Deluccia does come into this bubble nucleation, and we could talk about this, but that's not what I'm going to focus on right here. I'm just going to assume that somehow this bubble nucleates, that could even be in the field theory limit, and that it gets nice and big and classical before it collides, and so that is really just a question of evolving Cauchy data.
Question of the draw.
So in the case of that, say, both bubbles have a zero cosmological constant, so what happens?
If they both have zero cosmological constant,
yes, it's probably,
but there's still a domain wall in between them,
right?
Yeah. Well, I'll get it. Well, that'll be a special case. Okay. Anything else? Okay. So, all right. So we're gonna actually write some equations now. So, let's just figure out the symmetry first of this problem. So if we just had pure De Sitter space before we had these bubble nucleations, then we would have an SL41 symmetry. I'm going to work in four dimensions here, but that's really not important. But just to be concrete, I'm going to work in four dimensions. De Sitter space with one bubble inside it breaks this SL41 down to the symmetries which preserve the nucleation point. So we have an SO3-1. And when we have two bubbles, it further breaks it down to those symmetries which preserve both nucleation points, which is an SO2-1. And you can see this even in flat space. So let's go to the flat space limit for a minute. Just field theory decays. Okay. These bubbles have constant proper acceleration. They're hyperboloids. So this is now just a flat space picture here. And I'm going to draw it as a domain, as a sharp domain wall, although that's not important for the symmetry argument. So you nucleate these two bubbles here, and they collide. Okay. And they challenge my drawing technique here. They collide along some surface, which kind of comes out of the board. And let's actually write some equations. So the equation for this domain wall here, I'm just in Minkowski space, but the symmetry is going to be important to me, so I'm going to be a little bit pedantic here. So the equation for this domain wall is something like this. It's a hyperboloid, so it's constant proper distance from some nucleation point here. So I'm going to make this the x direction, and this is going to be x equals 0 here. And this is going to be x equals minus d. Okay, so that's the equation for this thing. Then we have the equation for this other domain wall. And let me just, for simplicity, make it have the same size. So this R0 is something that's determined by the microscopics, you know, and it's determined by some Coleman-Deluccia calculation or something. Determined by some tensions. That's not going to be the point here. So we have these two domain walls here. And then let's ask where they collide. So the collision happens at x equals 0. Kind of set this up in a symmetric way here. Okay, and the equation for the collision surface then is x equals 0, and also y squared plus z squared minus t squared equals r0 squared minus d squared. So this distance here is r0. Okay, and this whole distance here is d. So you can see that r0 is smaller than d. So this is a negative quantity over here. Okay, so this collision surface is t squared minus y squared minus z squared equals some. This is the equation for a space-like surface. So remember, this t, x, y, z are just ordinary Minkowski coordinates. All right, this is a space-like surface, and it's a constant curvature surface. Okay, and I think H2 is a conventional way of writing it. It's a two-dimensional hyperboloid. Okay. And although I did this in Minkowski space, this is really a correct statement in the full theory. The symmetries that are left over is this SO2-1. This SO2-1 is realized on these space-like hyperboloids in the region that we're interested in. Okay. So these cartoons that I've been drawing here, now we can continue drawing these in 1+1 dimensions, and just remember that there's a space like H2 that's suppressed, and it's a symmetry direction, and you can see the symmetry explicitly here. It's the boost in the YZT plane, which indeed is SO2-1, okay? Because all that appears is Y squared plus Z squared minus T squared in any of these equations. Okay, so that's the symmetry that's preserved. And so we're completely justified in drawing 1+1 dimensional cartoons. Okay? So, good. Yeah, if there's more bubbles, then you're going to break the symmetry more, and then it's going to be hard to solve explicitly for what's going on. But I think we'll be able to learn from this situation. We're going to be able to take away some important lessons. Especially if there's an eraser. Okay. All right, so now, yeah.
So I'm willing to consider the case of two, but you're saying that since there's an infinite four volume in the past, that chances, I mean, you're always going to end up colliding with something, probably. Is it very probable that you'll have, like, one collision, but say not more than one collision, or is it?
No, you're guaranteed to have an infinite number of collisions.
Okay.
But in a sense, these collisions are rare, because bubble nucleation is itself a rare process.
Sure.
So I think the logic is more that it's a bit confusing, because also this collision surface, you can see it's infinite. Okay. But it only eats up a finite part of this bubble. I mean, all I mean is that if you were to draw some time slicing, it would eat up a finite part of the sphere. So the idea is more that these are well separated in some sense. You have
okay.
some collision
so
over here.
Worry about
the
time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So in order to actually solve this, what I'm going to do is I'm going to work it in the thin wall approximation. Okay. And I'll argue later that this is actually going to that these results are actually justified. And so what I'm going to do is this. So I'm going to collide these two bubbles. I have these to sitter spaces outside here. Okay, I have this side here. Now, in general, when you collide two bubbles, there's going to end up being a domain wall in the final state, because we have some negative lambda over here. We have two different cosmological constants. There's going to be a domain wall separating them. In general, you can't conserve energy, because these tensions of these domain walls are fixed by the microscopics, whereas the energy in the collision depends on how far apart the bubbles nucleate and so on. So I'm going to have to do something with the extra energy. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to assume that there's some null shell of radiation going off in both directions. Okay. And, you know, we can improve on this later, but this is actually going to be good enough. All right, so now, in the thin wall approximation, inside this bubble, I have literally Minkowski space. In general, it would be some open FRW universe, but the thin wall is just Minkowski space. Okay? Inside this bubble, I have pure AES space. Now, after this collision, things can't be quite so simple. Okay? So what I have here is some something which I think Rob Myers and Gary Horowitz invented, which is a hyperbolic Schwarzschild ADS black hole. Do you have a better name for it?
I don't think we invented that.
All right. Well, all right, let me not write this in here. It's just going to clutter up the diagram. We have some kind of solution, some kind of vacuum solution, which has H2 symmetry and has some sort of mass term due to this shell here. And over here we have a similar term. So let me actually just label these at the moment. All right, and then tell you in more detail what these look like. Okay, so this is all going to be in the hyperbolic flex, so the metrics are very similar to what you get with spherical symmetry, which are more familiar, but they're a little bit different. So the metric here looks like this. And this function f in pure ADS space is just equal to, so this L is the ADS radius, and there's just some crucial minus sign differences. And the conformal diagram, this doesn't really cover all of ADS space, but it'll cover the region that we're interested in. We have R equals infinity out here. We have R equals 0, which is just the coordinate singularity in pure ADS space. And we have some horizons here. Okay. So that's A. This thing is this thing which I was claiming that Rob invented, but maybe there's somebody else who should be getting credit. And it has exactly the same metric. So let me call this thing F0 here. Except it has a mass term. Okay, so it looks like that. And the Penrose diagram looks the same. I mean, most likely, actually, these things should be curved in some way, but we're not going to need that level of precision. Except that now these coordinate singularities at R equals 0 become actual curvature singularities. So just in case you've lost track of the big picture here, what I'm going to do is I'm going to glue together these vacuum solutions across these thin shells of dust and domain walls. And that's like a cheap way of doing Cauchy evolution of Einstein's equations. And it will give us the relevant information that we need here. Okay. So I'm going to be using different pieces of these two solutions, of these four solutions here. So this okay. So A is just ADS space, B is this hyperbolic Schwarzschild ADS. C is this hyperbolic Schwarzschild solution. So the metric looks like this. So now the size of the H2 turns out to be a time-like direction. Okay, and this metric function looks like this, where this T0 is like some kind of mass term. Okay, it kind of looks like the Schwarzschild metric with some sign changes. And the Penrose diagram for this thing is a little bit funny. So we have T equals infinity up here. We have some time-like singularities. Fortunately, we won't be using that part of the diagram. Okay, and this is some horizon that's at T equals T0. And then D is just Minkowski space. in this hyperbolic slicing, and it has exactly the same metric, except h is just equal to 1 now. And the diagram just looks like this. All right, so T and R are just the size of these two-dimensional hyperboloids, meaning the radius of curvature. Okay, and these are the solutions that have the right symmetries. And now let me tell you the most important part, which is which part of these solutions we're going to use. Okay, so this bubble, we know this region is just ADS. Okay, sorry, that was a little bit ugly. And we know there's some collision here. This collision sends off some radiation, and on the other side of the radiation, then we're not going to be using this solution anymore. So this is the part that we're going to use here. And it's good to go a little bit beyond thin wall and remember that actually there's going to be a crunch here. Okay, and strictly in thin wall there would be a Cauchy horizon, but we know that that's unstable and there's actually going to be a crunch happening over here somewhere. Okay. Now, on the other side of this radiation, we need to go over to this solution. So this is B here. We have our radiation. And then we have our domain wall. And we're going to have to solve for the evolution of that domain wall. But between the domain wall and this radiation is the region I'm going to be interested in here. Let me now work from the other side. So in this Minkowski space, we again have this domain wall expanding out. This is this region D here. We have some collision that occurs there. On the other side of the collision, there's some radiation. And that's the region we're going to be interested in there. Now, the key point, which I'm not going to have a chance to derive during this talk, is that this collision is guaranteed to occur outside the horizon of this hyperbolic Schwarzschild black hole, which is a good thing because we really don't understand time-like singularities. Okay? And this was actually the part of our paper that I'm the most proud of, but it just doesn't really work well in a talk. So we use some fancy arguments about energy conditions and so on to prove that this is going to be outside the horizon of the black hole. And so then there's this domain wall, and again, we're going to have to solve for the evolution of this domain wall here. Okay, so I'm gluing together these different solutions. And now what I want to do is solve for what happens to this domain wall. Does it come over and does it go off to this infinity and ruin the time-like infinity? Or does it get repelled by the lambda equals zero region? Okay. The question is the dynamics of this domain wall.
Do you know that those mass parameters have to be positive in this?
This one has to be positive. This one actually does not have to be positive, but in the case that I'm talking about, it is going to be positive. But these black holes, as you should know, actually make sense with negative mass.
But it's not a question whether or not the Penrose diagram, there's a nice Penrose diagram. In this physical process, you know, you went from one space-time to another space-time, and then you're picking pieces of it. I don't know.
Well, so what I'm assuming here is that we end up with positive energy in these shells and so on. Okay? And then if this collision happens outside the horizon here, so there's actually two different cases. One is depending on whether the size of this H2 at the collision. So this is a subtlety, but that I'm not going to really go into. But
if you want
to it for one second. But okay, but in the simpler of the two cases, this collision happens outside the horizon here. And then the fact that this radiation has positive energy guarantees that this mass parameter is positive, and this mass parameter is positive, and everybody is happy. And there's another case which is more subtle, but again, the GR solution will make sense. And energies are all positive. Okay. So now let's actually compute what happens to this domain wall. So the way you compute what happens to these domain walls is you use the Israel junction conditions. And there's actually two of them. The first is that the induced metric on the domain wall has to agree coming from the two sides. And actually, this is already going to tell us something interesting here. So let me write the metric on the domain wall like this. So tau is the proper time along the domain wall. So this is a lower dimensional metric. And let's let R be the scale factor. Okay. So it's like a lower dimensional FRW universe. And we already learned something at this level. Now, we have three different symbols here, which are all denoting the sizes of the H2, okay? Capital R is the size of the H2 along the domain wall. Little r is the size of the H2 on this side, and T is the size of the H2 over here, and that's because it's time-like here, and so on. Now, the point is, as long as this domain wall is time-like, which is guaranteed to be, then T is going to go to infinity. T is a time-like coordinate. So this domain wall is guaranteed that R goes to infinity. Okay? The size of these H2s is just guaranteed to get infinitely big. And I tried very hard to do various twisted things to try to stop this from happening. This is just guaranteed to happen over here. Okay? It doesn't have to do with any dynamics. It's just kinematics, really. Okay? And the fact that this thing has to get infinitely big, it's what is going to make this thin wall approximation and so on rather robust. Because once these things get to be infinitely big, then, okay, maybe there was some mess in this collision. Maybe there was a lot of excitations on the domain wall and so on. We'll just wait till it gets nice and big, and then all that stuff will dilute away. Okay, so that's one thing we know. The second thing we know is that the second junction condition is that the jump in the extrinsic curvature is related to the stress tensor of the domain wall. Okay, and with this amount of symmetry, we can package this as just a single equation. And what this looks like is this. So these dots are derivatives with respect to this proper time parameter tau here. Here's the extrinsic curvature, some particular component of the extrinsic curvature coming from the ADS side. Here's a particular component of it coming from the lambda equals zero side. And what goes on the right side here is some parameter, which is the tension of the domain wall. Okay? And this F and H are this F here and this H here. Okay, so let me call this one H0. Okay, the domain wall is going between these two spacetimes, so those are the relevant things that go in here.
Density on the domain wall?
Well, I'm assuming this domain wall has exactly, I mean, in fact, this equation is true with this just being the energy density on the domain wall. But I'm assuming that this thing has exactly the equation of state, the classic domain wall equation of state. Okay, the brain equation of state, which is that T mu nu is proportional to the induced metric. Okay, so that's the assumption I'm making. And asymptotically, that's going to be true. And since this thing is going to get out to the infinite size, and that's what I care about, then that's what I'm going to use. Okay, so now we have these two different signs here. This plus sign is the relevant one if z dot is negative. Z is this spatial coordinate over here. So z dot negative means roughly, and I'll be more precise in a second, that the domain wall is moving to the left in the on the lambda equals zero side. Okay? It's a question of the velocity of this domain wall here. And z dot is And this sign is relevant in the opposite case. Okay, and which solution is relevant is going to depend on the tension. Only one of these will be able to be solved. Okay. And there's sort of a funny situation here, since we're doing GR, that somehow the domain wall can be moving away from an observer on this side, and also it can be moving away from an observer on this side, okay? Because this isn't really locally flat space. This domain wall has a big back reaction. That's what we're, I mean, that's why we're solving these non-trivial junction conditions. And with the minus sign, that's kind of the intuitive situation where it's moving out from the ADS side and it's moving to the right on this. But this is the intuitive situation where observers on both sides agree of which direction the domain wall is moving. Sorry? Well, yeah, that can happen. We're gonna get there actually. Okay. So all right, so well, yeah, it's funny. We don't really have any boosts left over because, I mean, these coordinates, I mean, we have the boosts in these H2 directions, but those we're not even drawing. So, no, I haven't assumed that. I mean, I've kind of used some coordinates where it just, there's some collision. There's some size of the H2 at the collision, and that determines, you know, some R at the collision here and some T at the collision there. And so, but there's no more freedom in choosing the coordinates. It's kind of. Well, that's there. I think somehow that's just not. That boost symmetry in the original de Sitter space, of course, doesn't really change this solution. And so I think in these coordinates that boost symmetry doesn't do anything. Because you can do that boost if you want to, but then I'm going to change my definitions of these coordinates so that this solution is going to look the same. I understand what you're asking, but. Well, you could, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You drew this nice T for constant in your drawing there?
Ah, sure. Yeah. Yeah.
The
constant T slices are like this.
But if you in the one which is glued? So in the upper picture.
Oh, up here?
Yeah.
Well, T is only really defined over in this region here. But let's see. So I guess T equals constant is something like. Something pretty boring.
But when you say that you specify the bubbles as initial conditions, so, you know, where do you.
You want to know where the initial condition dependence is.
Yeah, where you start and then how you let it evolve.
Yeah, good. So good. I should have said that at some point. So there's two parameters here that are specifying this. Well, there's several parameters that are specifying this solution that I'm going to be interested in here. Okay, the parameters are this parameter M, okay, this parameter sigma, which is the tension of this domain wall, this parameter T zero, and that's it. Okay, those are the parameters that are appearing here, and well, I guess the cosmological constant, okay? The ADS radius. So these two I'm going to assume are set by some microscopics, okay? And then these two, I mean, they're set by the center of mass energy of the collision, roughly. And also some microscopics, which tells you, you know, do you like to radiate energy in this direction or in that direction? Okay, so these two parameters, M and T zero, are the things which know about the initial conditions, but it's not actually going to be important for the asymptotics. So, well, Yes, once you fix all the microscopics, the only parameter is the distance between the nucleation points. So once you know the microscopics, that should tell you something like the ratio between these two or something like that. Yeah, T0 is this mass parameter. T0 is essentially telling you how much radiation you send off into the lambda equals zero side. Okay, so the point is this is some collision. You know that the energy density of the final domain wall. Okay? So in order to conserve energy, what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna throw off radiation on the two sides. Okay? The energy in this collision is determined by initial conditions. Okay? And well, in principle, I fixed them down here, but they're just going to come in through these parameters, and I don't actually care what those parameters are as long as they're positive. So in a sense, look, there's some complicated equation that relates these parameters to the initial conditions, but I'm not writing that equation. Okay? And there's two things which go into that. One is how much energy these things collide with, which is some function of the separation. The other thing that goes in is some microscopics, which tells you, you know, do you like to radiate in this direction or in that direction? Okay. So the well-defined evolution problem would be to take this potential and just do Cauchy evolution. That would probably not be consistent with just putting all the energy into thin shells. So if you like, this is a cartoon of the Cauchy evolution, where I've assumed that the radiation is emitted quickly. Yeah.
Kind of touches on this. I understand the matching conditions you used to relate the second and third Penrose diagrams you drew. But now to understand that in the context of the top diagram, I also have to consider the matching across the shell of radiation.
That's right.
The first and fourth diagrams, which is a little trickier because it's a null surface.
That's right.
I mean, how does... Is that
well, there's some version of the Israel junction conditions, which I'm not sure the right people to credit with it, maybe Wands and Maeda. But essentially, you take the null limit of this, and there's still some way of doing this. So matching across null dust is a pretty well understood thing to do. And
Well, exactly. I mean, roughly that's telling you, you know,
given this energy density here, what is M or something like that. It gives you some relationship between M and the energy density. Yeah. So, good. So maybe we can talk about, I mean, my main interest is...
But all you care about is that M is going to be positive, and that,
right.
That says that the energy density in the shell is positive.
That's right. That's right. But, you know, just keep in mind, I mean, an interesting question is, I'm doing some idealization here where these parameters aren't really going to matter. What you should try to do is think of some situation where really I'm not going to get, where my conclusions aren't going to be correct. Okay, but let me tell you what those conclusions are first. So I'm going to write down this matching condition here and plug in these formulas. So I'm just plugging in those. This is the same plus or minus. So what is our time frame here? Moving this right, this R over to the right side. Is 12 the?
I think we started a little bit late.
Okay. 12 plus a little bit. All right. So now we're going to go to large R. I mean, we could just solve these equations, but let's be lazy and just go to large R, which that's guaranteed to happen. And what I care about is asymptotic. Okay. So I'm just going to throw away the 1 over R terms. So this is the equation that I'm solving. So let's figure out whether which sign is the relevant one. Okay. So with the minus sign, right? remember that the minus sign corresponds to the domain wall eating up the Minkowski space. So let's just call that bad, okay? The bad situation is that the Minkowski space is getting eaten up. That's the minus sign. And the left-hand side of this equation, so this is some kind of funny mathematical property. You have a thing plus a positive number. Okay, this r dot squared minus 1 is going to be positive, because if we go to large r, we're just in Minkowski space, okay? And the metric is just, it's just dt squared minus dt squared, okay? And what that means is that in terms of this domain wall motion, so t is the size of the h2, okay? So t is r for this domain wall, okay? So for the domain wall, that means that since tau is proper time, all these equations are in terms of proper time, we have a relationship like this, okay? So that says that z dot squared is equal to r dot squared minus 1. We know that z dot squared is a positive quantity, so r dot squared minus 1 is a positive quantity, okay? So I apologize that capital R, t, and little r are all sizes of h2, so that I couldn't invent any better notation. All right, so anyway, this is a positive number. So we have a thing plus a positive number minus that same thing, okay? And that's less than the thing, okay? It's a true statement. This thing with the minus sign is less than this number, all right? With the plus sign, the left-hand side is bigger than r over l, okay? So which sign we want, whether it's bad or whether it's good, whether the Minkowski space survives, depends on this tension. Okay, so this is the relevant one if this tension is less than 1 over L. This is the relevant solution if this tension is bigger than 1 over L. Okay? So there's a very simple answer to the question of whether or not this Minkowski space gets eaten up. The answer is that if the tension is smaller than this the inverse ADS radius, some G Newtons thrown in here, then this is bad, and this one is good. This Minkowski space survives, okay? And let me just say in a little more detail what happens here, since we're kind of short on time. This is solved by some kind of exponential, and the domain wall asymptotically becomes null, okay? And so the two possibilities are that the domain wall either accelerates out towards infinity in this direction, that's with the positive z dot, or it accelerates out to infinity in this direction. Okay. From the ADS side, pretty much always the same thing happens. The domain wall always accelerates out to infinity on the ADS side. Okay. I mean, in a sense, you know, the ADS is the true vacuum, and so it's kind of guaranteed to be stable against this thing, so it repels this domain wall. Okay, so these are the two possibilities, and let me draw now the overall picture for the two different cases. Although I have to say that this is one thing for which the conformal diagram is not necessarily the best tool. So in the bad case, where this thing is unstable, the domain wall comes across and eats up all of the Minkowski infinity. All the time like geodesics end up in this crunch. So this is the bad. Yeah. Yeah, this is the problem with the conformal diagram, is this looks like it might be time like infinity. But it's actually not. I mean, any time like geodesic goes like this.
Okay, and now what happens in the good case is that we get to keep all of this infinity here. This domain will. Okay, we have some type of situation like this. It's a bit confusing because the domain wall is accelerating away from the point of view of both sides in this case. So I'm not quite sure how to draw it on this diagram, so I just draw it going straight up. Okay, so here we get to, so this is the good situation. We get to keep time like infinity. All right. And this is actually a black hole horizon here. Okay, this is this black hole piece. So is the basic picture fairly clear of what happens in these situations? So now, the most interesting case, which I'm not going to get a chance to explain very much, is when the tension is exactly equal to 1 over L. In that case, you can see that the solution to this equation is just R dot equals 1. So in this case, we have R dot equals 1, Z dot equals 0. So this is some plane that just sits there in Minkowski space. Z is really just like an ordinary Minkowski coordinate, okay? This is just a plane sitting there going up to time like infinity, okay? This is a little bit confusing. Because on the ADS side, this crunch is happening. And so it's a bit surprising that you could have a plane just sit there and sit around forever. And the reason is that this nice black hole is shielding the crunch behind it. Okay. So there was an eraser here, but I see why they pay you the big bucks. All right, so the situation in this marginal case is that so again, it's a little bit hard to see on the conformal diagram, but this is a piece of time like infinity. Because this is just some domain wall sitting there. Here we have some crunch. Here we have some black hole. And so this is a black hole horizon here. This domain wall just sits outside of this ADS hyperbolic black hole and moves actually farther and farther away from it. You can see that R dot is 1. And R is the size of the H2, so it's going out to larger and larger R in this geometry here. Okay, so there's plenty of room between this ADS hyperbolic black hole and the domain wall. You can have time-like geodesics with infinite length. And this is a bit surprising for a number of reasons. I mean, one reason is that we thought that producing ADS cosmologically always led to a big crunch. In this case, the crunch is avoided. It's hidden behind a black hole horizon. And we end up with an infinite four volume of ADS and infinite time-like geodesics. So that's surprising. Well, yeah, I'm sorry. We need some better tool, I guess. But they go up to here. Okay, here's the infinite time-like geodesic, and here's the infinite four volume. It's very small. Okay, yeah. All right, so that's a very interesting case. That's right. Yeah. So in this marginal case, we have all right, infinite V4 of ADS and so forth.
So what decides which of these scenarios?
Yeah, good. So now let me just in the last couple of minutes make a connection to
which tension you expect to get here. Okay, so so there's two things we can connect. One is we could just ask, not in this cosmological context, we could ask about the non-perturbative stability of this lambda equals zero vacuum. Right? We know that lambda equals zero, even if there's an ADS vacuum around, we know that lambda equals zero can be completely stable because of some funny facts about ADS. And the condition for that is exactly this. Okay, this L is always the ADS radius. Okay, so there's a connection between the non-perturbative stability of the of this Minkowski space and the stability in this context, the cosmological stability of the ADS space. I mean, sorry, the cosmological stability of this Minkowski space. And roughly what's going on is just that once this domain wall gets to be very big, it's basically a planar domain wall. It can forget about the collision and whatever symmetries you have in the problem. Okay? And the question of whether there exist planar domain walls in the theory which will eat up your vacuum is equivalent to the question of non-perturbative stability. It's not really a question of computing Coleman dilution incitons. It's a question of if you have that, if you start with whatever initial conditions, do you have objects which can accelerate out and eat up your space-time? Okay? If you have those, you're going to be in trouble. If you don't have those, you're not in trouble here, and you're also not in trouble here. Okay. The other connection, which I guess is probably not too surprising, is that we know that supersymmetry guarantees non-perturbative stability. Supersymmetry also provides a BPS bound on the tension. Okay, essentially by positive energy, which again is this same bound. Okay. So in any context where we know how to make this lambda equal zero with supersymmetry, we're guaranteed to be in this situation where the thing is at least marginally stable under these collisions. Okay? And finally, this connection with the BPS bound means that if you have a supersymmetric domain wall, then you're going to be in this situation, exactly in this marginal situation. Normally, I wouldn't have cared about this marginal situation. I would have just said that's an infinite fine tuning. Who cares about that? But the fact is that if this domain wall preserves supersymmetry, then we have exactly this formula for the tension. So in fact, it's more like a discrete choice. So I think this is actually a scenario that's worth analyzing, this special tension. And this, remember that this corresponds to the domain wall, which just sits there. Okay, so let me just briefly mention some things for the future without writing them down. So, you know, clearly understanding this beyond thin wall would be nice. Perturbations to the symmetry, whether those get out of control. I've tried to argue that this analysis is reliable, but it would certainly be nice to see that in some better treatment. And let me just say that the reason I think this is so robust is this. This little region of Minkowski null infinity, that's pretty much guaranteed by causality to exist. Because that region does not even know about this ADS bubble nucleating over here. You're pretty much guaranteed to have that. And it's actually very difficult to destroy regions of infinity here. Okay? In particular, you can send out as much radiation as you want. You need some kind of object which is not going to dilute as it goes out to infinity in order to crunch this thing. Okay, in order to stop this from evolving up to a nice time like infinity. So you need some domain walls. So that's why I think that this analysis is correct. I don't see how it's going to be changed by some annoying, you know, radiation or other dust being thrown off by the collision. And I tried to, you know, I tried to destroy it for some time before coming to this conclusion. Another issue is for these BPS domain walls, these supersymmetric ones, there might be a nice dual description of this ADS space. I think that would be interesting. Another question, which is sort of tangentially related to this, is if we now go to something where one of these vacua is our vacuum, you could then ask whether we should expect to have a collision like this in our past, and if so, whether it's observable. And this has been looked into somewhat by various groups recently. Well, I don't know if any of these people are here, but I know there are people here who like to do wacky alternatives to inflation.
And this is a wacky alternative to inflation. If you just make this five-dimensional and you make us live on this domain wall, then this collision could be reheating. And I didn't invent this wacky idea. I think, you know, Boucher and other people wrote about this. But this is a context where these supersymmetric domain walls could be interesting. And then, I mean, there's just two other questions. One is, now that we see that in some sense these nice asymptotics here are preserved under collisions, is there really a nice string theory formulation of this question? Is there a more rigorous way of getting beyond semi-classical analysis? And finally, I mean, really, we want to get away from the asymptotics of true vacuum regions to understand these places out here where we might be actually living. Okay, and so there's just a more general question of what is the right way to characterize these asymptotics of eternal inflation? I mean, there's kind of this slogan that eternal inflation populates the landscape, but actually making that quantitative has proved to be very challenging. So it would be very interesting to make some progress in that direction. Thank you. Well, I don't think it's really known. I think the reason is that ADS vacua we usually understand with large amounts of flux. And lambda equals zero, we usually don't have any flux because the flux tends to break enough supersymmetry that the cosmological constant is not zero anymore. And interpolating between large amounts of flux, where we have some control, and zero flux is kind of a difficult thing to do because you know, it involves a heavy object. So as far as I know, we don't really know whether these things exist. I mean, you know, you can in supergravity they exist if you really know, write down a superpotential. But whether they really exist in string theory, I don't think we know. Yeah. Well. Yes. If I write down a I can write you down superpotentials where that's the case. But then the question is going to be whether you really believe that those things. So. Yeah. Well, I don't think there's any reason to think that in string theory we have lambda equals zero with supersymmetry broken. So for this academic question, I mean, this, okay, I was trying to ask a simple question, which was asymptotics of true vacuum. Now, our vacuum supersymmetry is broken. So one question is, whether our vacuum is in this category, there's some rough generalization to the Sitter space. You know, could walls come in and eat us up? And I don't think we really know the answer to that question. But since supersymmetry is broken, we don't know the answer.
But there is a fundamental supersymmetry there. So if supersymmetry theory is right, then
yeah.
If you get a theory, there is a supersymmetry. So you would think both bounds should be satisfied.
No, that's not going to bound the tension. A supersymmetry in the underlying theory is not going to be enough to guarantee the stability of some non-supersymmetric vector. So I mean, that's an interesting question, but I think we could get eaten up by a bubble, as far as I know.
So the bottom line would be valid, even in supersymmetric theory.
It could be. I could try to think of a simple example, but I think, I mean, this bound guarantees non-perturbative stability. Okay, I think we know that even in an underlying supersymmetric theory, that vacuum is broken. Supersymmetry don't have to be completely stable.
Yes.
Are there any other questions? If not, let's thank Ben again.